Rabbi, is it okay for a pregnant woman to be a kvaterin at a bris? Or one of the unterfuhrers to a chuppah? Well, why do we have these chaperones in the first place? And what do they represent spiritually? Minhag Yisrael, who the Rebbe tells us it is a tradition, Jewish minhag, shebech yikonsei, shebech nosase shal yed lebrisa shal Avraham Avinu ol avashanam, when we take a child to have his bris, mishtatvin zug shal kvatis. We have a couple who bring the baby in. Ish ve'ishtoi v'cholei, typically a husband and wife. The woman brings the baby, usually on a pillow, to the door, the entrance of either the shul or the room where the bris will be. And then the husband takes the baby all the way to where the bris is going to be performed at the so-called seat of Eliyahu. Says the Rebbe, Minhag Yisrael Torah, as we well know, anything which is a Jewish custom is as powerful as the Torah itself, which means this minhag, this custom, must also be part and parcel of the Torah. So, inyan zeh, this idea, the fact that we introduce a woman into a role that is part of the bris, which if you think about it is a very male ceremony, even though a woman obviously does not have the mitzvah to have a bris and probably not even to give a bris to her child, although that's subject to some debate, could be that the basis, or at least an allusion to this custom, is in our parasha. Because the pasuk that says, and on the eighth day you should circumcise the child, which is the mitzvah of a bris milah, is written where? Ne'emar b'parashas Isha, ki says Rabbi Yehuda Zachar, is written in the parasha which is introduced by the name, and actually this becomes the name of the parasha, a woman who should conceive. Which is a parasha that initially speaks all about the laws of a woman in childbirth and post-childbirth. Straight after the pasuk, Isha ki says Ria, very soon after that you get Uvayu Mashmini. So the mitzvah bris is contextualized in the Torah as associated with a woman and childbirth. That alludes to the fact that a woman has a role to play in the ceremony of the bris. Even though the actual mitzvah to circumcise one's child is the father's mitzvah, and the mother does not really carry that obligation. As the Gemara illustrates, a whole debate whether or not a woman is even acceptable to give a bris. In spite of the fact that a woman has no obligation to circumcise her child, where does the Torah teach us the mitzvah bris? In the parasha, which is associated specifically with women. In fact, it's a section of the Torah where the husband is not even mentioned. Even the pasuk that tells us about a bris, about Yom HaShmini, Yimol, Basar, Olose, and on the eighth day, his flesh should be circumcised, doesn't even tell us explicitly that it's the father who is supposed to be doing that. So at the very least, that alludes to the fact that a woman does have a role to play in a bris. And what that practically means is that women carry babies to their bris as a kvatern. So now that we know that this is a well-founded Jewish tradition, that a woman brings the baby to her husband who takes the baby to the bris, it's interesting that many people have the custom that that woman should not be pregnant. Lavia sarachanim of the Beis HaKnesses when she brings the baby to the shul. Seeing as that is a very well widespread custom, moving sheshakach mokim, it must have some basis. Vapan hogazay. And that must also have the same strength of a custom which is like Torah. As the Rashba famously says, that if there is a tradition that has been passed down, even if it's a so-called Boba Maisa, it was passed down by the older members of the community, we can't just slog it up with questions because it doesn't make sense to us. So there's clearly a custom that a pregnant woman is not the woman to take the baby to the bris, and let's try and understand why. So the minhag zeh shemuberes lo tiyeh kvatern muvayim kama taimim. Various commentators offer various reasons for this. Mitzat zakona, perhaps it will endanger her, maybe the shock of the bris. Machlif shashayin hora ve'oid, or maybe it will attract negative attention to her, that he has a baby that's just been born and she's also pregnant. Maybe there's somebody who's battling fertility and will look at her in the wrong way, or various other reasons. But because we know that every Jewish custom is absolutely precise, It's quite likely that the real reason why we don't have a pregnant woman as a kvaterin is not because of these side issues, but because of something intrinsic to what the role is all about. Not that we want to bring any danger to the baby of a miscarriage or whatever the case is. But it somehow it speaks to the essence of what this custom of these kvaterin are all about. So, by way of introduction, let's just clarify that when it comes to why we have minhagim, and we say that these minhagim are Torah, there are two things we want to emphasize about these customs. Firstly, the most obvious is this minhag is like Torah. It's non-negotiable. It's not a matter of opinion. It doesn't matter if we don't appreciate and understand it. It is a valid minhag. As we use the expression, this is the custom that has been transferred through the generations from our forefathers, and we don't change those traditions. But there's another meaning to this line as well, which is Beis. Torah means instruction and lesson. So the minhag is also an instruction and lesson. And it's an instruction or an insight into the particular area that this minhag relates to. So if we have the minhag of kvaters, that must, and the fact that she can't be, the woman can't be pregnant, that must speak to what this custom is all about. So to get to understand what it is of a haktim, we're first going to introduce an important introduction, which is derech haminig hanal shel kvater bebris. Just like you have the married couple who bring the baby to a bris, we find that when a couple gets married, marriage and bris obviously have a very strong connection, because the purpose of marriage is to develop a family, to have children, and of course those children will then have a bris. So there the custom is also with unterfirers who accompany the chosen and the kala to the chuppah. Each one goes with a pair. Interestingly enough, the woman who accompanies the kala to the chuppah should not be pregnant. So there are contemporary or halachic books that say that these customs about not including pregnant women in these particular roles, not to be the kvatran at a bris, not to be the unterfirer at a wedding, chad min hogo, who is actually the same custom. And therefore, whatever the reason is that a pregnant woman should not participate, must be the same reason for both of them. So now that we've linked these two traditions, let's try and understand what about a pregnant woman is problematic. So the simplest way to introduce this would be to say, before we want to understand why a woman who is pregnant cannot take a certain role, let's understand the halachic designation of a pregnant woman, and we'll find insight into that in the custom about kaporas. That if a woman is pregnant on Erev Yom Kippur, she takes a chicken for her own, a hen, for her own kaporas, and then in addition, gam tanugel kapora avor haubar, an additional chicken or chickens actually, on behalf of the unborn child. So these chickens, there's two opinions. One opinion is she takes one hen, which would cover herself, and potentially if the fetus is a girl, and one rooster to cover the possibility that the unborn baby is a boy. Because technically you can have a single hen cover two people of the same gender, the mother and the potential daughter. Because we do that for adults or for regular people, that you can do a single chicken to incorporate more than one person for kaporas. Oy, but then there's a debate which says, maybe in order for her to do kaparas, she needs three different birds. Shtei tana goylois, two hens, one for her, one for the potentially female child. V'tana golechod, and one rooster for the potentially male child. Tana goylois achas avur ho'em, v'tana goylois v'shul safek avlad. Right? So the one hen is for her, and the other two are for, because we're unsure of the gender of the child. And that's what we do. Based on the teaching of the Arizal, that's how we do it, that a pregnant woman uses three chickens for kaporas. Now that's going to help us understand the designation in halacha of what a pregnant woman is. So we're going to bring this back to our conversation and then flesh it out. We have these two customs relating to pregnant woman. Minhag Yisrael, hein lagabei hashushbinin shel chosen vekala, v'hein lagabei hakvatas bebris mila. the custom, both about the chaperones who take a chosan and cut it down to the chuppah, as well as the chaperones who bring a baby to the bris, the custom issue, shnayim dafka, that they should be two chaperones only. Ish ve'isha, one of whom is a man and one is a woman. Oshnei anoshim, ushtei noshim, or the way that we do it, two men walk the chosan, two women walk the kala. But either way, it is only two people who accompany the chosan kala to the chuppah, only two people who bring the baby to the bris. So that would explain why you don't want to use a woman who is pregnant. Because then there's a third individual who is now part of the procession, the unborn child. How do we know the unborn child is something we have to take into consideration? Because at Kaporis we take this unborn child into consideration as an independent being who needs his own chicken or hen, rooster or hen, in order to do Kaporis. So then you've turned it from a pair into a procession of three, the man, the woman, and the unborn child, which upsets the balance of what you're supposed to have as the chaperones to a chuppah or to a bris. And the truth is that the genders won't be evenly balanced because there's either two males and one female or two females and one male, and that possibly is also part of the consideration, although the most obvious consideration is it's supposed to be two, not three people. Now, you could say, whoa, hang on a second, is the unborn child really an independent individual? You could argue. Let's be honest. The person who's actually carrying the baby to the bris, or actually walking the kala to the chuppah, is the mother. The fetus is not carrying the baby or holding the bride's hand. So why is this fetus any more of an issue than other people who might be standing around or even under the chuppah? We don't shoo everybody else away from the chuppah because you're only supposed to have two people. Well, Aval Achiluk Beneimu B'Pashas is actually a really simple reason why we're making this distinction. Because if there happens to be a crowd standing around the chuppah, standing around the Kisa Shel Eliyahu, nobody considers that they are part of the procession, that they are now chaperones, that they're interferers, that they're kvaters. But what's unique about an unborn child is it's not yet independent. It is considered part of the same entity as the mother. Which means if the mother is carrying the baby, then technically the unborn child is part of that organism carrying the baby or walking the kala down to the chuppah. And we have an easy way to make this kind of distinction based on another area of halacha where we don't consider people who just happen to be in a space automatically part of testimony just because they happen to be in the space. So by the same logic, we don't consider people who just happen to be standing at the chuppah part of the shushbinin because they happen to be standing there. So Adin, the halacha is clear. If a group of people comes to testify in the court, and then it turns out that one of the people in the group is disqualified from being a witness or is related to somebody who is one of the other witnesses, automatically the whole testimony is negated. That's if all of the people who witnessed the particular event intended to testify. The language of the halacha. They intended to appear in court and to testify. And there's even a view that would say they'd have to arrive in the Beis Din in order to testify before we consider them part of the group of witnesses. Let's say it just so happens that a father and son or two brothers happen to witness an event and they don't both intend, only one of them intends to go testify and take this to the Beis Din. So in we don't now disqualify all of the testimony because they happen to be a relative standing in the proximity. Because those people who happen to be standing in the proximity are not automatically testifying. Same thing, people who happen to be standing by the chuppah are not automatically considered the chaperones of the bride and groom, whereas the baby is, because the baby cannot go anywhere else except where the mother goes and is considered essentially part of the organism of the mother. Let's understand this better. When we analyze this further, we can actually explain it better. Once you go back and analyze the nature of how we do kaporas for a pregnant woman, it gives you a tremendous insight. That the child is not actually considered 100% independent of the mother. And that's logical because the child is not capable of sustaining, of living independently of the mother. Sharim Kain ein adav mubar. And in that case, things don't seem to make sense. Because, look, if I'm going to say that the child is not independent of the mother, then I'm saying the child is not yet an entity. What exactly does the child need to atone for? Does an unborn child need to atone for what? Rather, we have to re-understand that the fact that there's an unborn child in the mother re-qualifies what the mother is considered to be. The fact that there's a baby inside the mother's system changes the mother's status, so she is no longer seen as a single person, but is now seen as a multiple, which means two or possibly even three people in her. So in other words, we're not counting the unborn child as an additional being. We're saying the mother is considered a multiple being during pregnancy. Therefore, if the mother has to atone for anything that she did, and that's what kaporas is for, she will need multiple birds in order to do the kapara on the multiple facets of her being at this point. In other words, it would be ridiculous for a person to say, I'm going to atone, but not for my arm. Naturally, the whole purpose of kapara has to incorporate the entire body, and seeing as during the state of pregnancy, a woman is seen as an organism that is multidimensional, all of those dimensions have to be catered for in her kapara, or she is not atoned for. That gives us a completely different insight into why a pregnant woman cannot be an untifer, as we'll see. Let's just unpack this properly. Let's say a pregnant woman ate something that's not kosher, which then becomes part of her system, for which she needs to atone. Whatever is absorbed into her system through the digestive process is also absorbed into the fetus's system. And therefore the atonement has to incorporate not only her atonement, but the fetus's atonement as well. Signa nachr, to say it differently, koil yose in maybe a broader sense. Asiyas davar atzar kapara hi al yedei ha'odom. When a person does something for which they need to atone, they, the whole them, did it. And who is they? Well, you with all your evarim, all of your pieces. V'cholom iskaprim. And all of the limbs, all of the organs, have to be cleansed and atoned for. So if the particular subject of our conversation is a pregnant woman, not only do all the organs of her body have to be atoned for, but so too of the fetus, because we say that in utero, the baby is considered an organ of the mother and therefore needs the treatment of the rest of the physiology of the mother. So therefore, when this pregnant woman also takes a rooster for kaporas, in case her child is going to be male, that's not that the rooster is there to atone for the potentially male child in her. It's just that later, when the child will be born, and we'll see now that it is a male, that will illustrate to us that while she was pregnant, her needs for atonement included also atonement for a male component as well. Now we can understand why a pregnant woman should not be the chaperone for either the baby to the breast or the color to the chuppah. It's not because we're worried that there is now a third person in the room, the unborn child. But rather, the woman is a multidimensional being during the course of pregnancy, and she counts for two, which is problematic when you need an even couple taking either the baby or the chosan kala to the chuppah. But we still have another lingering question. Okay, so why do we need a man and woman, or husband and wife, to be the ones taking the baby to the bris, or the chosan kala to the chuppah? So we'll start with the chosan kala, because that's where it really makes the most sense. We can understand why you need a male and female at a wedding. The man will represent the chosen, the woman will represent the kala, and that's why you want a married couple, because that's what you're representing, marriage. But why would you need specifically a man and woman, and ideally a married couple, at a bris? So as we said, there's a lesson, there's an instruction over here, and the lesson and instruction must also speak to what the bris is all about. So before we can explain the kvaters who take the baby to the bris, let's understand the unteferers who take the couple to the chuppah. In Yonam Shal HaShushbinim B'Pashtosu, the simplest reason why we have chaperones at a wedding is, let's be honest, the chosen and kala up until this point were strangers to each other. So they're self-conscious and they may be a little embarrassed to go of their own accord and stand themselves under a chuppah next to each other at close proximity when they've been so chaste their whole lives. That's why we give them chaperones to assist them in the process, to ease the process. These are people who are close to, friendly, related to the chosen and kala, to support them, and to encourage them that it's okay, that this is appropriate and it's actually beautiful for you to be coming together now. And that's why you want a man and a woman, and ideally a married couple. Because the right person to encourage the chosen under the chuppah is a fellow man, and a married man. Otherwise, you know, who are you to tell me I should go to a chuppah? Somebody who's had the experience of marriage. And for the same logical reason, the woman who accompanies the kala should be a married woman. Now, whatever happens in our world is merely a reflection of how things are in the spiritual reality, because that's the cause of everything in our world. So, kol inyanu d'lemata, whatever's going on down here, mishtalshlim mishoshim lemaila, is the evolution of how things are in their spiritual source, v'alderech ze binyoneinu, as we shall see in our context. Because inyan ha'shushvinin de'ish ve'isha, b'chosen ve'kala lemata, these chaperones, the married couple that are supposed to take the chosen kala to the chuppah, bo'ilam hazeh, in our reality, shtalshim ikach, is an evolutionary result of the fact because that's how it is in the original and ultimate state of chosen and kala, which is based on isun kvayochel ben hakadosh baruch hu Yisrael, the ultimate state of marriage, which is the union of Hashem and the Jewish people, which happened when, as the Shlomo HaMelech says, b'yom chasu noses ematen Torah, at the time of Hashem's so-called wedding with the Jewish people when he gave us the Torah. Shebohem hoyu shnei shushvinin, at the time of the giving of the Torah, there were in fact chaperones. Shushvina de Malka Moshe. Moshe was, so to speak, Hashem, the king's chaperone, to bring the Shechina towards us. Shushvina de Matunisa Aaron, and our chaperone as the Jewish people was Aaron, who brought us towards Hashem. So Moshe Meshame Shushvin Mitzade Choson. Moshe is the one representing Hashem as the groom, meaning Moshe's job is to conduct godliness from the higher realms into our world, the Yisrael, to the Jewish people. And that is what's played out in our world as the person who's leading the chosen to the chuppah. Whereas Aaron is representing us. He's the one chaperoning us towards Hashem. That's because Aaron's job is to encourage the Jewish people, to draw us close, to elevate us from our lowly reality to a higher state, until we become absolutely connected and one with Hashem. And that translates in our world to the woman who's accompanying the kala to the chuppah. So why, if Hashem wants to unite with the Jewish people, do we need chaperones? That's because the Eibishter designed us in such a way that our neshamas should enter into a world which is very lowly and very distant from actually feeling a connection to Hashem. From this skyscraper down into some deep pit. Our neshama was hurtled down into the darkness and concealment of this world. Which causes the neshama to feel, not altogether unlike the couple under the chuppah, a sense of discomfort, a sense of self-consciousness, a bit of embarrassment. How do I appear in front of the Eibushter's unmitigated greatness? The fact that Hashem is infinitely exalted. So how do we get us there? So the Jewish people need somebody to coax and nudge us along the way to be able to get us there. To help and explain to us that who we really are in the essence of our being is we want to connect with Hashem and we want to do what the Eibushter wants, as the expression goes, that the so-called good wife does what the husband expects, which is actually speaking about our neshamas and Hashem. And that's our loss, and that's Aaron's job, you know, just to coax us, to elevate us to the point that we connect to Hashem. And the reason that the Eibushter needs a so-called chaperone is because the Eibushter represents the masculine energy, which is a controlling or powerful energy, a ruling energy, dominating energy. That energy shouldn't overrun and totally dominate us, but should seep into our reality in a way that we can actually accept and experience and appreciate. So because the Eibushter wanted the facilitation of Shushvinin in order to have this union with us at the time of giving of the Torah, that's how it is in our lives as well, and that generates a tremendous amount of simcha. That's why these chaperones to the chuppah are considered contributors to the great joy of the chuppah. One of the greatest reasons people experience simcha is newness, something brand new that's being created over here, a new relationship and the foundation of a new family. That's what a wedding is all about. These are two people who, from the day they were born until now, were completely separate from each other, possibly for most of their lives, didn't even know the other one existed. They're half a reality that could be totally distant from the other half. So what do the Shushvinin facilitate? The bringing together of these two lost halves so that they can reunite and have this new experience of life. That generates a tremendous kind of simcha. That experience we have in real time when we have a chuppah is just a reflection of how things are spiritually. Because the neshama had to descend into this lowly world. That caused the neshama to have an experience where it feels totally distant and disconnected from where it was and how it was connected to Hashem. Compared to how neshamas are in the higher realms. But when we, as Jewish people living in this world, can create this incredible union between ourselves and Hashem through the mitzvahs that we do in the Torah that we learn, that and we impact our world and elevate and refine our world. And we're not just reuniting ourselves with Hashem, but we're reuniting those sparks of godliness that scattered all over this world back to their source. That generates a tremendous simcha on high. That's why the description Shlomo HaMelech gives of the day of the giving of the Torah is not just the day of a wedding, but the day of Hashem's joy of his heart. We know very well, the Midrash tells us, that until the Torah was given, there was a Berlin wall between the holy realms and the unholy, the mundane and the divine, and there was no way of crossing that boundary. Like the two souls that are completely separate and unaware of each other. But at the time of the giving of the Torah, which is the equivalent of a wedding between Hashem and the Jewish people, they tore down the wall. And that created an incredible union between Hashem and the Jewish people. While we are very much in this world, invested in this world, and via us, this incredible union between all the disparate parts of the world and godliness. And that's why it's such a tremendous time of simcha for Hashem. Now that's how it is at a wedding, and that's why we have chaperones at a wedding, to remind us of this unique process of bringing together Hashem and the Jewish people, which is reflected in bringing together two individuals who were separate and now have become a unit. Now, how does that relate to a bris, where we also have these chaperones? So now we can understand what the kvat is all about and how they link to the unterferes at a wedding. See, the bris milah is the ultimate expression of and the deepest expression of this union between Hashem and us. First of all, it reiterates every single time that there is a bris that Hashem has a permanent covenant between us in our physical form and Himself. What happens at the time of a bris is Hashem's covenant becomes emblazoned on our physical form in a way that you can never undo. That means that what Matan Torah represents in concept is experienced in real when a person has a bris. Because a bris encapsulates exactly what the giving of the Torah is all about, bringing the divine down into the physical experience, elevating the physical body that it now has this eternal covenant with Hashem. To the extent that, not that my neshama has an eternal covenant with Hashem, my body has an eternal covenant with Hashem. Because the bond that we generate between ourselves and Hashem through any other mitzvah, despite the fact that, yes, of course, every single mitzvah is a form of connection and bonding with Hashem, is not something you can detect in the human body, to the same extent that you could detect a bris, which has physically altered the form of the body. And that gives another layer of appreciation to what the Alter Rebbe says in Shulchan Aruch, that what? That the first time the neshama truly enters the body is when? At the time of the bris milah. So if the giving of the Torah is represented by a wedding, and that has the chaperone, man and woman, representing Eibishter and Yidden, the bris, which consolidates what marriage is all about and consolidates what Torah is all about, the fusion of the divine and the physical, must have a set of chaperones, man and woman. Mipnei, she'inyonomuhu l'sayah b'kirba yichud b'neihem. So how's about the chosen and kala? The chaperones are supposed to help facilitate the union. Hashulshin mitzad ha-chosen, hashulshvinu mitzad ha-kala. The man for the chosen, the woman for the kala. So that same process must also be reflected to illustrate this union of Hashem, the Chosen, and us, the Kala, in the bris, which is in an unusual way, unusually deep, unusually profound way, and therefore you need the kvatas there as well. And so how do we illustrate this message in our tradition? By having kvatas, shem ish v'isha, which are a married man and woman. The husband will, in this scenario, represent the chaperone of Hashem, bringing the divine into the space. And the wife will represent the elevation of this child in their physical body to become a receptacle for godliness. And therefore at a bris, exactly like at a wedding, the chaperones have to be ish ve'isha, dafka, a man and a woman, ideally a married couple, and not a man and pregnant woman, which is a multidimensional being. That also explains to us why a bris is meant to be joyous like a wedding. Which we don't find this level of emphasis on simcha in every mitzvah. Yes, there's the overriding principle that every mitzvah has to be driven with joy. Like we know the pasuk in Tilin that says, I rejoice over your words, Hashem says. The Chazal tell us that's referring to the bris. And that's why the Gemara Nida tells us that the bris is deferred to the eighth day. Why? So the Gemara says, because we don't want to have a scenario where the entire bris party is joyous, and the husband and wife are not, because she's not yet able to go to the mikveh. After 7 days, al pi Torah, she would be allowed to go to the mikveh, and that would bring joy to the couple as well. And just linking this back to what we said right at the beginning, that the bris is in the parasha of childbirth, which alludes to the woman's participation in the bris. But it's also here that we learn that a bris should be on the eighth day after the 7 days of impurity post-childbirth, and so therefore that alludes to the fact that we really want the couple to be able to enjoy the simcha fully. And if she'inyan ha-simcha, why is simcha such a key component of the bris? Because the idea of simcha is ha-misori mitzadin shlischachos, as mentioned, simcha, one of the things that generates simcha is when you've got something that is renewed or something that is brand new. Like a wedding where something new is being created. The man is leaving the life that he used to know, and he's forming a brand new life where he becomes one unit with his wife. Kenal. So that is kind of shlemus mitzvahs mila. That idea of generating something brand new and therefore generating a tremendous simcha through it is especially so in the case of a bris. Because as we have explained, what the bris does is it cements the union between Hashem and the Jewish body in a way that is unparalleled in any other mitzvah. You'll say, what about a woman? Where does a woman ever have the opportunity to create this fusion of the divine and the mundane? Well, the Gemara tells us very clearly that a woman is considered as if she already has a bris, and therefore the moment of a woman's birth, she already has this fusion of neshama and body of the divine and the ordinary. So then, when we fulfill these two mitzvahs that we've just learned about, pru uruvu, to have children, which is tachlis ha-shachasna nisu isha v'isha, which is the ultimate expression of the purpose of marriage, or mitzvahs mila, and the mitzvah of having a bris, nizke b'kare mamish l'gudu ha-mitis v'ashlema, those mitzvahs should hasten very quickly the arrival of Mashiach, v'azayti ha-shlemas ha-mila, when we can experience the ultimate state of mila, which is promised to us, where the Eibishter will circumcise our hearts, in other words, remove the impediments to spiritual sensitivity that we have within ourselves. And we'll also have the ultimate state of union between us and Hashem, that it says in the time of Mashiach, not only will we be married, but we'll be in a state of intimacy, and we'll be accompanied by our original and ultimate chaperones, Moshe and Aaron, and experience the heightened, or the ultimate state of connection and union with Hashem, with a gula amitit vashleima, immediately now.